This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother, Chris. In this episode, how productivity gets bottlenecked. Say you're in a bridal party. Groomsmen, bridesmaid, anything in between, doesn't matter. You have a bachelor party to be at, a tire to buy, places to be, things to know, people to meet. You don't want to bother the bride or the groom, but someone has to take charge. The best man or the maid of honor. But what if there's too much to handle for them? What if there are easily solvable problems, but you need to go through one of them to get those problems solved? Aren't you creating more work? Probably. The bride or groom don't want to deal with your problems. The maid of honor and the best man are a bottleneck. And beyond the confines of a wedding, it's an issue for governments, businesses, and even science. So how do you get around it? Do you address the size of the problem? Do you open the bottleneck? How do you even recognize it? And welcome to Game Theory. I'm all confused this morning. Game Theory, a podcast about competition strategy and decision making. And Chris, we were thrown off of our routine because
we're out of whack right now. Both of us,
we're bamboozled. Occasionally when I travel for work, I've got my setup. It's a little clunky, but I can bring it on the road just fine. We've done it before. I've recorded in San Diego, and we've recorded it here and there. And I brought everything I needed except for like this little cord that connects the battery to the thing. And we're like setting up like, where is the cord? And to be honest with you, I still haven't found it. I thought that it would just be on the floor right next to where I should be packing, but I have not located it. It should be fine because that's the only for the mobile thing. Regardless, we are sorry. Chris recorded the apology. He sounded apologetic. I do want to make one thing clear though, because I didn't think about this at the time, but I'm thinking about it now. Half of the apology was an advertisement for Spotify for Podcasters. However, we did not make any money off of that. We did not monetize our apology. We simply use it as a way for Chris to record the ad that will now be playing in episodes that we do monetize and also endorsing the product that we like. Both things are true, but we did not make money off of our apology. That would be stupid.
Yeah, and we apologize for even giving that impression.
Yes,
I should have been clear about that from the outset. 100%. We are completely bamboozled. Normally record before Tuesday and we release on Tuesday. And we're technically, we're before a Tuesday. But not the regularly scheduled Tuesday. Right. And that's thrown us completely off. I was injured on the morning that we were planning to record.
Yeah.
I was trying to do a hip sled and I injured myself. I thought it was the safe alternative to squatting.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, oh, yeah, this would be a good way for me to get like a baseline level of leg strength so that I can return to squatting because I lack strength through flexibility right now. Mm-hmm. And that reared its ugly head that same morning. So a lot of factors at play.
I have found, for those of you that don't know what the hip sled is, it's the thing that you sit and you kind of, you're on your butt, but your legs are kind of in the air. It's like a leg press, but you put plates on it. It's a little bit more fancy, or a little bit more intense, I guess. The problem with that, and I found the similar thing, you can hurt your back because you go heavy, and if you don't get up and walk around between sets and you're not super flexible, you can hurt your back. And it happened to me a year or two ago.
I did get up and walk around between sets, but I'm not super flexible.
Ah, that and there.
I started stretching again recently, and I thought it was working wonders. I thought, oh yeah, I've incorporated this into my routine such that I'm going to be safe and healthy. Mm. And I was not. I guess I have been playing a ton of Legend of Zelda, so stretching a couple times a week is not enough to offset the ungodly amount of time I've sunk into that game. It's incredible. I wish we were advertising for Tears of the Kingdom. We're not. But I could.
No. Everybody has. Everyone endorses the game. It seems to be, I'm going to let it go for another month. And if it's this popular again in a month, people are still talking about it, then maybe. Because I don't have a system. And I'm not ready to buy a system for one game until people are like, this is a moment in time. Because this is not the only game this year where people who are not video game people are into a video game. The other one was the Hogwarts game, the Harry Potter game. People are obsessed with that. It's a lot of fun.
That was also a cultural phenomenon based on a completely different set of franchises, too. So there's the movies that gained a ton of popularity that were based on the books, which were obscenely popular.
Right.
Zelda, though, is pure video game. I mean, I think there's been like crappy Zelda cartoons, and they sell merch and all that kind of stuff. But bro, if you're waiting for someone to tell you this is a moment in time, you're just got you got cotton in your ears or something. You got to clean those bad boys out. This is a moment in time.
Most sports are ending soon, so July might be that time, and then we shall
truly
see. So okay. Yep. So that's our apology. We apologize for that. We haven't really screwed up going weekly. We do push it on when we record, but we also like sometimes shit happens, and like we would like with the debt ceiling one, we had to wait because the Congress people were had their thumbs up their asses, and we needed.
Which,
to
by the way, if we haven't made it clear on previous episodes, they have passed debt ceiling agreement, sure. So now the debt ceiling is raised indefinitely until 2025, and by indefinitely I mean like the quantity until 2025. And so
yay.
It came to pass. There was there was brinksmanship and all this kind of stuff. Very, very funny movie. Very funny video footage of a certain congresswoman from maybe Colorado.
Possibly Colorado.
Who, after the vote, said that she did not vote as an act of protest, but was seen frantically running up the steps of the Capitol, surprised to find...
Yeah.
Like be informed by the person taking the video that they had closed the vote
yeah.
and that it was no longer open. And it was obvious that she was trying to play it off after the fact as like a deliberate decision. But really, she probably was just partying too hard. I say partying too hard. And I think a lot of people think, oh, yeah, this is just a euphemism for doing whatever you want. Like, I really do think there's a huge element of people in Congress who resent their people that they represent, and they will do anything to stay in Congress so they can continue getting invited to swanky upscale cocktail right. parties 100%. At fancy places and no rub question. Elbows with rich people.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened here.
They'll never be rich. They'll never be famous. They'll never be talented. Their talent is kind of acting in person to get the people to be elected. There's no doubt. Being in Congress seems objectively sick. The job seems
Congress is
terrible.
Out here catching strays, even though they deserve to catch some strays, metaphorically, of course, on the basis of like their brinksmanship and gamesmanship right. with the future of the U.S. economy and really like global well-being.
Yes, I agree.
So it does. That's cool. where we're at right
that
now.
That was so funny. It was. Watching her run up the stairs was great. Did they close it? Like, yeah, dude, they closed the door. Like, there are deadlines.
And then she like turned around and kept running up the steps.
Like, oh, okay.
It's really funny.
Yeah, it is great.
The last reason I'm all out of sorts, I'll tell you. I don't know if you can get this down in Carolina, but the air quality here is terrible.
Yeah, it's not good here. It looks like there's a fire somewhere, not super close by, but it looks like there's a fire. Like, definitely.
Yeah, it's a code maroon here in Washington. We're recording this on Thursday, June 8th, 2023. There's code maroon alerts, mostly up toward Baltimore, but it's like code red and code whatever the thing is between red and maroon. I think it's like a code purple, maybe.
Right.
Don't go outside. I'm not saying that as like it's good for public health. Like, this has nothing to do with anybody else. It's like for your own benefit. Do not go outside. Just chill at home. Perfect time to fire up Zelda and get going. It's really like it's bad. New York had it bad yesterday.
Yeah.
I think it was like a truly Philly apocalyptic looking day.
In Boston is going to have it, they think, today as well. But it was the photos out of New York City are bananas. That no question.
Crazy.
Air quality, air quality is an interesting thing. A lot of research coming out of China. We don't know. I mean, we don't take a lot of stock into that medically, but also in California about like the long-term effects of living in places that get wildfires are not good. So yeah, stay inside if you're on the Eastern Seaboard. It's gross, and that's what's happening. And it helps people with allergies and asthma. It can really, really, really screw you up. So got to take care of yourself. So we did get a piece of feedback on our debt ceiling episode that was mad that we were kind of broing out. And I want to address something very clearly, that we are not experts. And if this is truly the only podcast episode that took the time to explain this, do it, no, you won't do it, do it, no, you won't do it, brinksmanship stuff, that makes me sad. But we should not be the people that you're going to have a genuine debate on, A, the debt ceiling, nothing to debate, raise it or we're going to fall apart as a country, and B, on what brinksmanship is, because that would also make me sad. I can't believe this hasn't been broken down by somebody smarter than us. So you are here to listen to us bro out and tell you, all we are here is to set you off on your Googling and your Wikipedia and your YouTube rabbit hole. We are just pointing the ship in the direction, and your darkness is up to you.
Yeah, we're not here to lie to you. We're not here to spread misinformation or disinformation or malinformation. We're not here to do that. We're just a couple of guys who want to talk into a microphone. So please, obviously, don't take anything we say as like we're never giving advice to people.
No.
We're not claiming to have monopoly on what constitutes truth. We're not even claiming to be that well informed about stuff, except that we prepare for every episode right. by doing some research. And we're talking about things that we have already seen and already learned about, as opposed to kind of going on the fly and making stuff up and shooting from the hip. So we're not full of it, but we're also not like full of knowledge and wisdom either. Yeah, so this is highly encourage you to, if you're interested in any of these topics, this is a baseboard, and you should jump off springboard.
Of it. Yep, spring. Baseboard. It, jump could be, off it could be a baseboard.
Spring,
yeah.
spring forward well, we into don't, the font of knowledge.
Whether or not people go up or down is, because we don't off. Sometimes we try to go up and we don't end up going down, and we dive into a shallow pool, and who knows what's going to happen. We did meet a fan. Player 3 came up to me at my work event. He happened to be, so this is crazy, at a work event last year, I came back and someone that I was there with at the event through my company and his company was like, oh my God, is that you? I was like, yes. And then we got to shake hands and meet. So shout out to Andrew. No last names on blast right now, but shout out to Andrew and the senior living business. Dining and senior living, really cool. Chris, there are senior living communities that are going to be on Uber Eats now. They make good food good enough that you can order food from senior living communities and have it delivered to your door. That's going to happen soon.
Wow, that's awesome. You diversified those revenue streams, senior living companies. Mm-hmm. No, that's really great.
Yeah, they do. And they have food trucks and stuff too. So then there's PR and blah, blah, blah. So that's what I was doing and where I was traveling. And we were ready to record, et cetera. So now we are doing a day late. Oh, one last thing. So we're going to go back to the Tuesday schedule. That sucks for this episode. We apologize, but we need to wear it. It's our responsibility. We screwed up. So Tuesdays is going to be the way moving forward. Today we're talking about the theory of constraints and bottlenecks, and this idea is very simple. Everybody knows what a bottleneck is. It's what happens when you're on the interstate and all of a sudden it goes from 3 lanes to 2 lanes and you're like, well, where do all the people go? This is super annoying. And it transcends traffic, right? It's your emotional capital. It's social capital. It's what companies can do. The 80-20 law, 80% of people do nothing and 20% of the people do 80% of the work and all of that kind of thing. So let's get into, Chris, the theory of constraints and how it pertains to the theory of bottlenecks, which constraints is like a widely accepted thing. That's on Wikipedia. Bottlenecks is a little bit more scholarly.
I think in a sense it's a little more scholarly and it's a little bit more everyman, like layman. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's named after the neck of a beer bottle.
Yep.
Because it slows the flow. Well, it reduces the volume through which a fluid or a substance can flow. And that increases its velocity, but it also serves to back up the overall flow of the thing that's in the container. The reason we're talking about this today is because it's not an anniversary, but there was a book that was published in the year 1984 that was called The Goal. It was an novel written by, we're not talking about that 1984. We're talking about a book written in 1984. It's a novel. It's not dystopian, but it is a little bit, now that we've had 40 years to kind of marinate on management strategy and lean and effective business building, it is a little bit strange to kind of think that the topics that are covered in this novel were truly new and novel and a little revolutionary at the time. So the book was written by Eliyahu Goldratt and Jeff Cox. Mm-hmm. And it tells the story of this guy whose mission is to overhaul a factory that he oversees within the span of 3 months or else face foreclosure. Yeah. So it's as low stakes, I think, as you can get and still legally be called a thriller. there's a plot from this book that says somebody, this manager, has to format a slide deck by midnight or else, gasp, he won't get enough sleep to function properly the next day.
Which, it's like honestly, stuff like that. Honestly, maybe this sounds like it'd be a really great limited series because that is an anxiety producing thing. Like if that sounds like an HBO show that is so slow moving, you got to really be into it. But we are all living in this world where, actually, if I find myself awake at 10:45 instead of like at 9:45, it's like panic time because you might be awake till 11.
Yeah. I mean, for at least like the laptop class of workers.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. Routine matters.
Yeah,
sleep matters. Rest matters. Makes a huge difference. Anybody who's a new parent also can tell you. Sleep is. I would say it's, you know, standing on the other side of that fence. Mm. It seems to me like the most precious resource that people immediately lose out on once they enter into parenthood. That's not to say that it's not worth it.
Yeah,
but it does seem to be. It goes from scarce to there's a shortage of this.
Yes, forever, essentially. So, okay, so if they don't do this, they will lose out on a lack of sleep. What a plot. I love this plot already. Yes. But this guy, this novelist, and we on this show are starting to come to the conclusion that novelists may be the smartest people in the history of humanity in any given era. They are just so good at this.
Yeah, I do think it is worth saying that I argue that it's possible to learn more about a culture, a time, a place, an idea, a people, ourselves, by reading fiction that's well-researched, that's like backed up, about the time and place than it is to like read textbooks or try to watch documentaries or whatever about
it. I'm with you for sure. So this is one of those novels and one of those pieces of art that came out between 75 and we'll say 2000 that kind of really drilled down in what it means to be a day in, day out American. They come out with this idea of the theory of constraints, the theory of bottlenecks, this idea that no matter what you do, it is all going to get clogged at a certain point.
Yeah, that's the arguably the main contribution of the book, in fact, is talking about how stuff starts to get slowed up. It's not like every process that's involved in a particular, every sub-process is involved in a particular process slows at the same time. It's that the overall process is limited by its worst part. You've heard the phrase, you're only as good as your weakest link.
Right, yeah, of course.
Yeah, this is that. And one of the characters in the book, this guy named Jonah, who's this, he's like a business advisor who travels the globe. He gives the definition of like the term bottlenecking and this theory of constraints. A lot of times, I think it's worth pointing out, people often consider bottlenecks to be like, oh yeah, there's a process bottleneck in this, I don't know, manufacturing facility, or there's a process bottleneck in how we get paperwork through the organization or whatever. Sometimes it's physical. Sometimes it's policy-based, so there's a rule in place that's holding everybody up. And sometimes it's people-based. So here's just like a quick story. I don't want to talk too much about like how individuals can slow things up, because that's an entirely separate thing. But at a previous job, I had to go get a certification, like a little badge, basically, that said, I'm certified to do process XYZ. So I talked to my direct line manager, and my line manager said, oh, Chris, I don't know. I think it's going to take a couple of weeks. You're going to have to be really patient on that. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this isn't okay. I need this thing by like tomorrow, truly. So instead of waiting a couple of weeks and seeing what my line manager would do about it, I went directly to the office that was responsible for handing out this particular badge. I asked for it and I got it within about 15 minutes. So I think that's probably an extreme example, but this is a case where the guy who was supposed to be the conduit for this kind of stuff, the office manager, ended up being like truly an obstacle. Like I was unable to do my job until the point at where I was able to get this little badge thing. So I just simply went around the bottleneck. That was a true like a person bottleneck. There was no policy in place. There's no physical constraint. I just walked over to a different part of the building and asked someone else. So there are a lot of different ways in business to have bottlenecks. They can take a lot of different forms. And that's related to this theory of constraints, because the theory of constraints is kind of Gold Rat's idea, one of the authors of this book. And it's a formalized management paradigm wherein every single system that you could manage is limited in achieving more of its goals by a small number of constraints. And the reason they call these things bottlenecks is because ostensibly the bottleneck is the smallest part of the bottle. It's not the overall process. It's not like you're drinking out of like a pixie stick. It's like there's a container of liquid, and the rate at which it can go into your mouth for enjoyment is constrained by one small part of the feature. It's an important feature. Mm-hmm. And in the case of bottles, I would argue that it's actually good.
Yeah.
But in any manageable process, there is a small component or small subcomponents that are going to be the limiting factors. There's one weak link in the chain beyond which you can't increase the load, otherwise the whole chain's going to break. The rest of it can be excellent. The rest of it can be doing its job perfectly. But truly, the small bits and bobs are where the difference is made. And so this theory of constraints is about characterizing the constraints that are placed upon the system and trying to work within those constraints, but also try to adjust the constraints so that what might be perceived as a weakness or actually be a weakness could eventually be turned into some kind of strength, or at least neutralized in some way, so your company or organization or process can derive value.
Yes. So, and I think that there's an argument to be made that bottlenecks are good in certain ways as well. So if you were drinking a beer, if it's just an open bottle, a can of beer, when you used to crop the top of the can, an old school one, it would just say like beer on it or whatever, you can get it from Costco, those kind of things, and they would just dump it on your face. Or like if you ever tried to pour out a glass of water and it runs down the side and it makes a mess, there is real applications to a bottleneck metaphorically and also literally. I think an example that came to my mind immediately of how this is good and also annoying at the same time, but better than the alternative, is for anyone who has ever been in a bridal party, how specifically, and I don't, we're not going to have a conversation about gender here, but I have heard more stories about the maid of honor side of things than the best man side of things. So I will just say, when there's a big bridal party, say 6 to 10 people, all of the bridesmaids, they need their dresses, they need their stuff. Where are we traveling? What's the bachelorette party? Stuff that happens in a wedding, right? Typical stuff. You don't want all of this organization, this group of people talking to the bride because she has other things to do. And you don't want them all to just be in this like Quaker society of like, well, let's all decide together. Like, no, the bride is the person of the wedding. So the maid of honor is the bottleneck.
It is. Yeah. So you got to have a good best friend. You got to have a good maid of honor. You got to have a good best man. I was actually at a bar last night. I met a friend of mine from happy hour, and she was talking about her bachelorette had been planned by her best friend. And this is somebody who is already married and for whom she had planned the bachelorette.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, you know, I think there's a lot to like about the schedule that I received from my maid of honor. She said, there's built-in introvert time. Said she can't recommend enough. Ladies out there, I don't know. This certainly applies to me. I'd be interested in this. If you're planning a bachelorette party, fellas, if you're planning a bachelor party, highly recommend one of the days between like 3 and 5 p.m. build-in time so that people are just not doing stuff.
Oh,
you don't have to cram activity into every single hour of the day. Take an early or mid-afternoon nap, rally, and get going. Also recommend that for tailgating.
Yeah.
For night games, night football games, build in some time so people can chill, decompress, and get ready to go. Because you want to have maximum enjoyment. And sometimes that involves a strategic retreat.
Yeah.
But
the point
of this is that she said, she was delighted with the schedule she received, but also, she pointed out that it was a little bit easier. So, for example, her bachelorette party didn't involve getting on a plane.
Yeah.
And her maid of honors did.
Sure.
Her bachelorette party involves about a dozen people. Her maid of honors involved like 2 dozen people.
Yeah. And those are the kind of logistics we're discussing here, right?
Yeah.
So whenever you have to have someone to go through that can manage this. And that person has a tremendous amount of power. And also most people hate them because of having to do this job, whether it's a bachelorette party or a wedding, essentially, because the maid of honor does much more than the bachelorette party, a wedding, or like at your office, someone that this person that you have this go between. Now the badge is an objectively stupid example. However, I'm sure that person serves a role in other tasks where they would be like, hey, what you might not know is that guy hates this guy. And if you go do that, everyone's going to be pissed at you. I am the person that is going to manage that situation. I'm going to make sure that your time isn't wasted and that this isn't a mess. So these bottlenecks they do have a practical purpose. However, the biggest issue is that person can then at some point realize the power that they have, or those people, or those steps in the process, and then that bottleneck can get stretched out and more people want power on top of them. I read a short story not for fun.
Brag about your education. Brag about your education. Do it again.
Yeah, I was required to read a short story, and I read it, and it was the most painful read of all time. It was about the Chinese Communist Party in the 70s, and it was
what is it called?
I actually don't know. It's on. See the little red and white one back up there. Other Voices, Other Vistas.
Is it the one? You mean the red and white? When you mean the white one with like the red top and bottom?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, little itty bitty. It's an anthology of world literature.
Okay.
I mean, it's a pretty book, and I read 3 stories in it.
The
story in the Chinese Communist Party is there's like something is happening on a pig farm, and the entire story is just about how ridiculous, how hard it is to fix the problem on a pig farm. And they literally have to go all the way up to Beijing to get some fucking pig farm guy. And then he goes back down the line. It takes like weeks, and like the pigs needed to like a new pen or something. It's like the bottleneck got stretched out because of the way that the Chinese Communist Party runs things. But also you can see how the guy who's like down the street, instead of having to go up the chain of command, which he's required to do because of the way that things are working, he could just like get out of his house and walk down the street and see the pig pen and be like, all right, let's just build a new one. But he's not allowed
perfect
to do
example.
That. Yeah.
Absolutely perfect example. And you see that all the time. I mean, the term that people throw around is bureaucracy. I mean, that's really is what it is. And sometimes, you know, bureaucracy does have its function. You know, bottleneck has a function of getting fluid into your mouth
at
the optimum rate for enjoyment. Bureaucracy can sometimes prevent people from doing things that would be bad for like the overall structure of a system if it's like a really heavily designed thing. And the Chinese Communist Party, say what you want about it, and I say a lot of crappy things about it because they suck, but they do have the skill of doing a lot of centralized planning. Whether those plans work out in reality or not, that's a separate question. But they plan and plan and plan. So if the plan is really contingent on the bureaucracy slowing, like the rate at which the plan is implemented, that if that matters a lot, then bureaucracy has the positive function of slowing things down. But for people on the ground, for people who are on the pig farm, it doesn't make a difference. They need the damn pen so somebody can go out there and just build it. There's a short story also by Kafka. Who is Kafka-esque? That's by Franz Kafka. It's about Poseidon. Did you know he wrote a story about Poseidon?
Nope.
Yeah, what? Of course, he's most famous for The Metamorphosis, where he writes about the guy that turns into the pug.
Right, yeah, yeah,
freaky,
yeah.
Freaky story. I don't know if you ever read it. But the plot of this... Yeah, I mean... Okay, so I want to shout out again to Allie. Allie had the brilliant idea for our book club of reading books that people say they've read, but have never actually read. I feel like Metamorphosis is one of the short stories that people are like, oh, yeah, of course, the bug guy. But they haven't actually dug into it.
The Arrival guy, too, is a good one. I have, because I like the movie so much, but whatever that story is, too.
Well, the movie's good. The movie's interesting. I'm not a huge fan of the way it was solved. I think you're talking about Ted Chiang.
Ted Chiang
is the name of the author of the original short story. 100%. But the plot of this Poseidon story, I'm just going to pull this off the wiki, because it's a short story and it's really funny and interesting. But the story is, Poseidon is sitting at a desk and making calculations on the waters he has to manage, because he's the king of the ocean. For his work, he could rely on his staff, but he prefers to work on his own. He doesn't like the work. Doesn't enjoy what he's doing, but he doesn't see an alternative because he doesn't trust the staff. So he laments that people imagine him constantly chauffeuring the waters with his trident, but instead he sits in the depths of the ocean doing continuous, monotonous calculations, hardly ever actually seeing the sea. So he has occasional trips to Jupiter, from which he returns angry. He sees the sea during a hasty ascent to Olympus. He's afraid he's going to have to wait to the end of the world for a quiet moment and a tour of the sea. So basically, this guy has taken it upon himself to manage the entire ocean because he won't delegate to his subordinates. And as a result of that, the whole point of being the king of the ocean is completely lost. And that's like a self-defeating bottlenecking mechanism that doesn't have to be that way. But one guy in charge of this process has decided, nope, I'm unilaterally taking over this whole thing. And he literally, in the story, turns the ocean into a bottleneck.
Yeah, and I think, first of all, that is an incredible story about, like, what is the point of being this? And we see this every time. I mean, it was a Game of Thrones, and Succession was kind of like this. Any story that involves power, once power is achieved, I'm reminded of House of Cards. When power is achieved, the person who gets the power realizes, like, oh my God, it's actually so boring. This is really hard, and I don't want to just sit here and do nothing. But then they also like the power, so don't trust the people under them to kind of do the thing, and then those people kind of create niches for themselves, like, you go through me. Okay, so theory of constraints. How do you get the maid of honor to be an asset and not a liability? That's the question. So there are 5 steps, according to theinternet.com.
Well, specifically, we also have resources from the Lean Enterprise Institute, to be slightly more specific. I have in front of me an article written by one Sergio Ratner in September of 2006. I don't know what you have, but I'm sure they're the same steps.
Is it Ratner? No, mine is from Lean Production.
Okay, so Lean Production, I'm looking at the Lean Enterprise Institute. If you're seeing a theme here, there's a reason for that. And we are going to discuss this, because we always come back to social capital when it comes down to the workplace. Uh-huh.
Okay, so we're going to do the five focusing steps. There are 5 focusing steps. And I'll be honest, like, man, even 5 focusing steps, I'm losing my social capital. Let's make it 3. There's no way it can't be 3.
You can't. Okay, you're losing your social capital, or you're losing your ability to study and retain information.
Just put it in the... My favorite thing about being a white collar employee.
Are you trying to bottleneck this episode? Are you trying to bottleneck 5 constraints down, 5 components of the theory and down into 3?
No, literally.
Wow, you're seeing it before your eyes. Three.
All of
I live and breathe.
Project management softwares that exist, we use one of the famous ones to do this show, and sometimes it's really helpful, and other times, like, you know, we've done our stuff, we're ready to go. So most of the time, it is really helpful, but I found that just blaming the project management system is the greatest way to find a constraint, when it's really, like, the fundamental way everything is set up. Like, oh, it's Asana's problem. Just put it in Asana, just screwed up. I don't know.
It's a good workman that blames his tools.
Correct.
I think is the phrase. So what are the 5? So the question is, how do we get the maid of honor to plan the bachelorette party in the optimal way without slowing things down, without causing interference? How do we get the theory of constraints to work for us?
Okay, the first one is super duper easy in our maid of honor metaphor, and that is to identify the constraint.
It's right there.
Yep, there it is.
It's right there in front of us.
The step that I don't really understand is the second step, which is exploit the constraint. Now, after you exploit the constraint, you want to subordinate and synchronize the constraint, elevate the performance of the constraint, and repeat the process. So you want to make sure that the constraint knows, the maid of honor knows. This is step three, is make sure the maid of honor knows she's not the bride. Step four is to help the maid of honor do her job and make her feel like she's really important and really appreciated. And step five is repeat the process. So that's the one we can cut. That's the easy one. Like, duh.
Well, hold on now. If you don't have sustainability in a process, you haven't invented a process, you've invented a solo project.
If a step in a process is to repeat the process, then that step is a constraint.
Huh.
I mean, it's like, I know to repeat the process. I have a job. Like, yes.
Yeah.
Like, what am I doing tomorrow?
What are you doing tomorrow?
That's a good working. Question.
Yeah, okay.
Constraining.
Well, so let's go back through, because I've got a little bit more information from Gold Rat. So I forgot to mention, this guy Gold Rat, he actually wrote a second nonfiction follow-on to this book, The Goal. In 1997, he published his nonfiction version of, it's a book called, I gotta find it on the page. Critical Chain is what it's called.
Yeah.
So this was his project management book, wherein he formally codified this stuff. And that's where you get these five steps for the theory of constraints. And according to the Lean Enterprise Institute, Sergio Ratner, the thing to do in step two, for example, in deciding how to exploit the constraint, Ratner writes that Gold Rat instructs the change agent to obtain as much capability as possible from a constraining component without undergoing expensive changes or upgrades. So basically, put in some amount of effort, exert some amount of capital, expend some amount of money to improve whatever that process is. So if you got a weak link in the chain, get a good welder to come and fix it. But what that can't mean is expending more money or spending more time or putting more people on the job than makes sense to do. Because if you spend all your resources and you become weak in other areas as a result of trying to fix the bottleneck, you haven't really improved the overall process. You've improved the bottleneck, but you haven't strategically managed all of your resources. So without spending too much, you got to try to address it. And then subordinating everything else is a really interesting one. Because so after you've exploited the constraint, after you've tried to improve it in some way or exact some value out of it, the next step is to subordinate everything else. And Ratner writes here, the non-constraint components of the system, so the ones that you don't really have to worry too much about, they have to be adjusted to some setting that's going to enable the constraint to operate at maximum effectiveness. So in the case of a bottleneck, the rest of the container of the bottle is not the problem. That's not holding things up. The actual neck is.
Right.
But if you have a 55-gallon drum attached to a glass bottleneck for a bottle of beer, you're going to spend a long time hoisting a 55-gallon drum to get that fluid into your face. There are better ways to do that. First of all, drink responsibly.
Yeah.
But second of all, the size and operating effectiveness and the amount of time that the other components are operating, they have to be scaled down to meet the bottleneck. So in the truest sense, you're operating the overall system within the constraint of you are only as good as your weakest link. You are only as capable as your least capable component. Because if everything is speeding ahead, then in manufacturing, you would create huge stockpile buildups. And that might institute another bottleneck because then you've got to get a lot of material that you've produced that's ready to go into the bottleneck step. But you got to find a way to store that. You got to find a way to transport it. You got to find a way to break it down so that it can fit into the bottleneck. And if there's more, you've created more challenges for yourself and more work. So scaling down the other operations, they have to be limited by the least effective factor.
And this is not just a person. So our maid of honor, I think our maid of honor metaphor is a great way to do this, because theoretically to exploit the constraint, a very simple solution would be, say there's a bridal party of seven and this is a non-bachelorette part of the wedding. You'd be like, why don't I take part of this responsibility from you? I will go pick up this. I will make sure everyone's on schedule and I will report back to you. So you make sure that no one's feelings are hurt and you say, you are still in charge. I will do it. I will CC you on every text. You can screenshot anything you want. I will handle that for you. But it doesn't have to be a person that's a bottleneck. And we've been kind of on that as the metaphor. So I will give you an example from my professional life, which I live in. I work in senior living right now. And that is, I mean, you think about old folks' homes, but when you become 55 years old and maybe you want to live in a community and maintenance-free and all of these things where one retires, a retirement community and assisted living and dementia care and things like that. in this industry right now, there is a preposterous bottleneck. And the bottleneck is a market. And that market is the labor market. We can't find enough people to work at the communities. Now, working at a community does not pay quite as well as some of the really famous retailers like, say, Target. But they're also, it's quite a bit more fulfilling, and there really are, you can still in senior living go from the bottom to the top. You can become an hourly worker and eventually wind your way into the C-suite. But because people aren't there working, these communities, which are trying to regain occupancy lost during the pandemic for safety reasons, they can't because there aren't enough people working. But there is tremendous demand to get people into the communities. The people want to go. The communities want to have them. They have the rooms. There are not enough people working to safely care for the people that want to be in there. And they're trying to figure out how to get this bottleneck to relieve the process. And they're stuck. There's no way. The only way to do that is to pay them more and to make things better. But the only way to pay them more is to make sure that more people are in the community. So we found ourselves in like a cyclical bottleneck in that industry. And that's just my professional life. I'm sure this exact labor thing is happening in many other industries where there, and manufacturing is a great one too. There's demand. We can't make them fast enough. What the hell do we do? How do we grow appropriately so that like shipping isn't a problem and marketing isn't a problem? And then all of a sudden HR is a thing. So this bottleneck can be an idea or a system or a marketplace as well, not just one person kind of getting in the way.
Yeah, certainly. We scale down the examples so that it's a little bit more relatable day to day if you're not in a specific industry. But you're exactly right. You remember, I think it was like 2021 when there was a huge like supply chain concern that spilled over into 2022. And it wasn't just because that huge boat got stuck in the Suez Canal. That was
really funny. Hilarious.
But it really did have like a huge economic impact on like Egypt and the entire Middle East region and global supply chains. But there were also just a ton of shipping containers and crates and loads that were supposed to go in and out that just couldn't. And there were a multitude of reasons for that, and we won't get into it, but the point is that a lot of manufacturing processes, a lot of basic economic processes that involve the transfer of goods and services, they were contingent on the supply chain and didn't go through. They were bottlenecked quite literally at like the shipping port.
Hold on
real quick. Edit this out. I'm gonna flag it. I gotta plug in my power cord and the sound settings might adjust, so all right, we happy?
Yeah, you ready?
Not quite.
You good?
Yeah, we're good now.
So the supply chain obviously impacted pretty much the way to build and sell things. For example, I just bought an electric vehicle, and the way that this electric vehicle is working is that there's a demand for it, so people order it. Oftentimes, minimum 6 months, they'll make your car for you. Oftentimes, people will wait for 2 years, and at that point, they would just find another way to get it quicker. So this car would be built and delivered to the dealership, and then that person had to pay a fee to build it, but then that was an agreement to buy the truck. And so then it just sits there because they can get out of that for like $500 or whatever. So they do. So here's this truck that there's demand for, and then if you're Ford and Chevy and you want to make these electric trucks, they're like, holy shit, we should be the biggest electric vehicle. I mean, Ford F-150 should be way more popular than Tesla in the electric vehicle market, not even close. They literally can't make them because the little itty-bitty cobalt is not available, and that's a different ethical concern. There's like slavery happening in Africa. It's out of control. Yeah, you Google that. They caught it on video. Wow. People like threatened their lives to get it on video, and they got it on video, and it's bad, real bad.
Yikes.
Yeah, and it's at the point where activists for these cobalt mines are like, the United States should just take over. We should just like go conquer the country and just take the mines because it's bad.
Sorry?
It's bad. Google it. Go down the rabbit hole.
You know, I think those are the exact words and phrases that the European colonists use to colonize Africa.
I'm telling you right now, this cobalt thing is going to be a problem.
Oof. Like a problem for the supply chain, or are you supply talking chain? Strictly on the grounds of, you know,
the entire
servitude.
Geoeconomic shit show is going to come down to whether or not we can get the nickel and the cobalt and whatever you need to make your, remember our Moore's Law to make our chips.
Yeah.
And they come from places that are not savory, and those places know, like, oh, look at who's got the goods now. And so they're not exactly, they don't have bottleneck infrastructure issues. They just have a population that they, like, has to eat. So it's a mess. It is a mess, and it's not going away anytime soon. So that's for a different podcast. That's actual journalists need to teach you about that.
Yeah, that's a big boy topic. That's above and beyond our pay grade.
No, we are here to do office space and sports, and that's what we're about. Okay, so once we have exploited the maid of honor and said, hey, I see you are capable of this. There's not enough hours in a day. You're lovely. I will do some of the job. Then we need to figure out, are there too many bridesmaids? Are there too many people come to this bachelorette party? How the fuck do we figure this out and make sure that this bottleneck can support the 55-gallon drum that it is fixing, right?
Yeah. If those steps don't work. So I gave you a bunch of crap for trying to bottleneck the five. Yeah,
of course.
Five steps here.
Totally.
In a sense, they kind of are bottleneckable, because mm-hmm. step four for how to make all of this work is described as elevating the constraint.
Same thing. See, we've already eliminated one and combined two. There, we're down to three.
Well, we can't really combine, because subordinating everything else versus elevating the constraint, that's a little bit different. So remember, the first step is identify. The second step is figure out how to exploit. So make the small improvements where you can to get as much out of mm-hmm. the bottleneck as you possibly can.
Right.
And then scale everything down. Step three is scaling everything down so that subordinate to the bottleneck, the leading edge, is the slowest factor. The fourth step here is taking whatever action is necessary to get rid of the constraint. And you shouldn't really do that if steps two and three have been successful. If you're able to make the small improvements that maximize your output from the bottleneck, and if you're able to subordinate the rest of your process such that it continuously runs smoothly, then you don't really need to try to take any action necessary to get rid of the constraint. Because if the process is working, the process is working. This step involves making major changes to the overall
systemic
process.
Yeah, systemic changes. Sure.
And so you use the example of an electric vehicle. The example here would be, okay, I can only drive my gas-powered vehicle so much within my budget. I have to commute every day. I have to go to the store for groceries and stuff like that. I have to run errands on the weekends. So when I plan for road trips and stuff, I have to build this whole gas-buying thing into my budget. And that's fine, but I can only burn gas at such and such a rate. My vehicle is only designed to have XYZ number of miles per gallon built into it. So I can't make that more efficient. If you're totally unable to work this budget then on the basis of the road trips and all the other requirements that you have, the bottleneck is how much money you can spend on gas. Well, if you just can't make it work, if you've scaled down the rest of your lifestyle to fit within the needs of your gas budget, then suddenly you might need to start thinking about, okay, I need to get rid of this vehicle because I can't afford to continue living under this gas budget. But that's a huge change, because you can't just like make it into an electric vehicle.
No.
You got to go out and buy what are still pretty expensive electric vehicles.
They're more expensive than the car, which is the issue. So it's, are you able to take the savings and spread it out over time in exchange for like, it's similar like to buying a house. Like you pay the mortgage pays for it over time. You're like, okay, well, we'll pay the mortgage off. Can you do that and then take the savings as they come? Or are you in a position like, I would like to do that and that would be better for me in the long run? It's basic math, but I simply can't finance the upfront purchase right now. And that's part of the bottleneck issue too. Like the solution is so obvious and it's right there, but you can't do it because there are other constraints on the system. So the process is broken. So
let me give you another interesting example quick. This is a niche example, but it's going to resonate with our folks back home who know the Trona mines, know how important they are.
Sure.
People have needed soda ash for like millennia. The Egyptians were making soda ash. It's good for like the bicarbonate solutions, and it's good for medicine. It's good for food. It's good for all kinds of stuff. Cosmetics, glass making, you name it. There's probably some sodium carbonate somewhere in there. So people have been making it for a long time and for like centuries. In like the 17th, 18th centuries in London, they used to make this chemical using the Solvay process. It was really, really energy intensive. And the thing they burned was coal. So all this like smog that's outside right now because of the wildfires in Canada, that was like a daily occurrence in London, and people's health was just absolutely in the gutter as a direct result of that. So this Solvay process was really bad for the environment. It was really bad for the health of people, but it made a chemical that they needed. But if you fast forward to like the late 1940s when people are doing surveying and they basically discover what trona is and that there's a huge patch of it easily accessible, it's kind of like pre-made sodium carbonate. So now they can do the same process without the bottleneck of how do we get rid of the environmental concerns. I mean, the real problem was it was more of like a cost imposition thing. So it wasn't like they couldn't do the process. But after a time, people realize one of the results of this process is too harmful. And so you have to constrain that.
Yeah.
You have to constrain your productivity for soda ash because it means improving people's quality of life, improving quality of life for like the overall city, improving people's individual health. It's a real problem. And so that was like a policy imposed constraint. Natural trona exists and it solves basically all of those problems because it prefabricates the chemical reaction process and doesn't require as much energy. So starting with the building blocks is a complete systemic overhaul from the Solvay process. You don't need to start from scratch from precursor chemicals because you already have those. So that would be an example of completely changing the way that the system actually works. Now, this was a fortuitous case because they happened to find the exact mineral they needed.
They found the thing that they needed, and it happened to exist in abundance in a place where no one was. It was perfect.
So for the electric car example, it'd be like if you won the lottery, if you went on Price is Right and you won an electric Ford F-150. That's how lucky they had to get. But the point is that this elevating the constraint step, it truly is like, okay, we need to revamp the system. We need a new strategic approach to get rid of this bottleneck because it is no longer sustainable. We can't maximize its output and we can't afford to subordinate the entire rest of the system to this one thing. Yeah. So that's like a drastic step, but I mean, sometimes you gotta take it. Sometimes processes are just unsustainable and you have to get rid of bottlenecks by scrapping the whole thing.
Right, but there's another example where it's exactly the opposite, which there's not going to be a solution, I think, and we talk about medicine and patients' rights all the time, where a lot of people have a lot of really interesting research ideas for therapies and a whole bunch of different things happening in medicine. However, and a great example would be cancer. There are a couple aerospace engineering kind of people about 15 years ago who theorized that frequencies can kill and target cells and that this could cure cancer theoretically, and it could cure it systemically. That
frequencies is in, you mean like sound waves or light
correct.
Waves?
Sound waves. That at a certain like Hertz level, the sound wave could target cells of reproducing cancer cells or human cells and healthy cells, and then at different frequencies respond to different frequencies. And they could test it on like blood of different animals and things, but at a certain point, in order to prove that something is efficacious or in order to prove that something is bad, like it took 60 years essentially to prove that smoking cigarettes does cause cancer in some people and it will be bad overall for most people. That took a long time because of the constraints of this. But to try therapies and figure it out, at a certain point, you've got to bring it to the big leagues and try it on a person. The problem is that many therapies exist already for these cancers. Right? So you have to convince a bunch of people that are dying or that will die if nothing is done that, will you try this thing? If it doesn't work, you will die. Or would you rather go with the thing that will probably get you 5 to 10 years and maybe 20? Like, well, that's an easy answer. Like, I'm going to go ahead and go with the one where I will maybe live. And so when there's a new cancer therapy, you always start with the people who are the sickest. But at that point in stage 4 cancer, you could be in a situation where you don't know if it's effective or not because the cancer is so advanced that it may or may not work. So this patient right bottleneck, and this is just a cancer example, but ethically and morally, it has to exist. So the only place that we're going to see genuine progress is in the targeting of therapies that we already know exist and work, or in diseases that people have no options, where it's better than nothing, we'll give it a shot. So for example, the most exciting field of therapy right now, and maybe doctors will say this or that, for the last 10 years, it's been cancer with targeted immunotherapy, and everybody should know who Jim Allison is, and it's amazing. But the next frontier is addiction and behavioral medicine.
There's a lot. And like with the prominence of gambling in American culture, with like recent Supreme Court rulings that have allowed states to determine whether gambling is more legal, so it's much more widespread now, that addiction in general, whether it's to substances or behaviors, it's going to be another major like social issue. I mean, opioid epidemic.
Opioids. Is
a perfect example.
Eating disorders are bad. There's like addiction to computers and things that are bad, but there's no hope. There's some methadone clinics and there's some other drugs like that can really help certain kind of diseases. But for like alcohol, there's nothing. There's been a rise in Ozempic. Ozempic is the drug that everyone's using to get skinny.
Have you heard about this?
Have I heard about it? You want to hear a story?
Yeah, I want to hear a story about
it. Ozempic has Ozempic is like the Walmart version. There are many other semaglutide like drugs, and they're
sorry,
really good.
Semaglutide.
I think that's what it's called. Semaglutide. So that's the generic name. So we're no free marketing here.
Semaglutide is.
I forget what it's called. Is it SGLT2 inhibitor? I don't know. Whatever it is.
I don't know.
They're diabetes drugs, and they really are mind blowing for diabetes. Incredibly helpful, and one of the side effects is that you may lose weight. Well, it's because it kind of changes your behavior a little bit. Here's my story. When I was acting, I did a commercial and I filmed it. It took 2 days for a competitor of Ozempic. And it was a big break for me because when you start in commercial acting, you're either the voiceover person or you're the person like not talking. And then they'd get a voiceover person to seem like it's you. The big break is when you do a speaking role, when it's your face and your body and your voice. So you like are doing genuine acting. I shot it. I made $1,000 per day for 2 days. Big deal for me. They never went with the campaign for not for advertising. The drug never marketed itself as a weight loss drug. So the commercial was me. I had lost a bunch of weight and I was telling my friends like, do this. I'm not even going to tell you what it was, but it was not a shot. And they just housed it. This company is just keeping it. They're happy to make money off diabetes right now. And yeah, so this is going to be a thing. So these drugs though, because people have no hope for being addicted to alcohol other than AA, and they have different, like gambling is like that. They're like very interested in, there's a lot of research in psychedelics because these people will do, I mean, people who are addicted to heroin and alcohol and gambling, they know they're addicts. They know it's ruining their lives and they want to stop. They physically can't. They're like, it's like an allergy that you give yourself. It's really intense, but that's where we'll see progress because there's nothing. In cancer, where there is stuff for a lot of stuff, you can't convince people, like, will you be one of the brave ones that takes a risk? And if we just turn out to, like, that sound waves can't cure cancer, you'll die. That's a bottleneck. And we're going to look a human in the face and say, will you please die for our for the future? Like, I'm going to have to pass, bro.
Yo, there's a disturbing number of people in this country that would ask that question in all seriousness.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Wow.
I agree.
Well, I think the last thing I want to turn to here is... it's more related to the lean and effective philosophy that underpins this theory of constraints. Because so medicine, I think, is a different field because it has to do with human health and well-being.
Right.
There's still plenty of money to be made by that. People still view it as a management process.
Totally.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
But we kind of joked earlier, like I'm looking at the Lean Enterprise Institute as an example of a source that would write about this sort of thing. You're looking at what, lean programming?
Lean production, which I think is the
lean
same
production
group.
Yeah, yeah. It's... the site I'm on is lean.org. That's the parent domain. I think the interesting thing about all of this is that it kind of stems from this 1984 novel that was later turned into a pretty lucrative management book written in the mid to late 90s that truly espouses the social capital sacrifice for right-sizing and lean and effective management that became a general workplace phenomenon during that time period. We've talked about this on the show 1,000 times. I'm bringing up bowling alone again. You guys, at this point, it's a cry for help. I just want to go bowling with somebody. So player three, hit me up. I just want to go bowling. That's part of the reason I bring this up. But one of the big chapters about the workforce here identified this trend of companies that were in 50s, 60s, and even early 70s, a lot of people would get their social capital by being a part of the workplace. And I'm talking company picnics, company events, company entertainment for the family, company housing in a lot of places. You know, say what you want about company towns, like there are a lot of problems associated with that. But there was also like a strong union presence where people could do things like have a union picnic and have union event nights, and people could get in it, like personalized services that would improve like their quality of their relationship. They can, you know, there were what we would call now like everyone was going to therapy. I don't know how prevalent that was, but the point is there were a lot of benefits from being a part of a workplace that extended well beyond a paycheck and like medical benefits. There were a lot of reasons that people had to continue to invest their time, their energy, their social life into this workplace. But then in the 80s and 90s, for whatever reason, whether it's like business, the U.S. economy becoming more business information focused as opposed to more manufacturing and production, whatever the cause was, there was this shift in the mindset of upper level managers and executives toward trying to cut down on costs and generate more revenue by kind of trimming the fat and being more focused on delivering the products and services that the company was had identified as its core competencies. And of course, they want to diversify, but they still want to be really, really excellent and have this lean management style where they're not spending a bunch of additional money. So gradually, little benefits like the company's putting on like the annual picnic, like gradually that kind of stuff goes away. Mm-hmm. And then one of the other big factors about jobs was that it was a source of social stability for people. So the union presence made a big difference with this, but it was less common for people to be fired or, you know, summarily let go in the way that they kind of are expected to now. I mean, if you talk to any millennial or any Gen Z person, their resume is going to look a lot more diverse and have a lot more varied experience on it because people don't stay in jobs from the time that they're 18 to the time they retire in the way that they used to during those decades. And that's in large part because of social expectations, social opportunities, but it's also because a lot of companies shifted their focus away from providing social stability and making happy employees and dedicated employees toward lean and effective management. So the trade-off is the employee buys in less to the company culture, they buy in less to the, you know, rah-rah team spirit kind of stuff, but they also are easier to move around. So when an organization wants to be more lean, they can cut people. When an organization wants to do step four, like we were talking about, they want to elevate the constraint, they totally restructure things and suddenly people might still be in a job, but they're in a different job. They might still get a paycheck, but their paycheck is working on different projects, is working with different people. And what that does is erodes social capital in the sense that it incentivizes people to keep their heads down, try to survive, and do what it takes to continue bringing home the bacon without buying into the company culture. Like, so now it's no longer as common to hear people say, oh yeah, I'm a, you know, company X man, I'm a company Y man, company Z has been really, really good to me. And now it's more common to say, I am a tradesman, or I am a, you know, coder, or I'm a whatever. And then you work for the paycheck and you don't really, there's no sense of loyalty to the company. There's no sense of personal investment from the company. It's,
which is ironic because I'll tell you that hiring people and filling gaps and when you need to hire people and turnover is one of the most costly things. And I don't think that these companies adequately thought about how difficult it is to find talent and how much money they are wasting because nobody trusts them. Now there's a documentary and we'll get out of here, I guess. And we are sorry for being late on the episode. There's a documentary that really, really, really drills into it, in my opinion. It's the Downfall. It's called Downfall, I believe, on Netflix. It's about the Air Max 737 disasters that Boeing, those planes that Boeing fucked up and killed a bunch of people, and then they blamed the pilots. Nope, not true.
Not the pilot's fault.
Not the pilot's fault. And it goes into the core genesis of how this really happened. And it goes back, just like any good documentary would be, with a thesis, which is that it goes back to the beginning. Boeing used to be one of these places where, like, I work for Boeing. Like, I'm moving to Washington. I love it. Pilots had the saying, if it's not Boeing, I ain't going. Like, it's, and now they have, Boeing's number two now. Airbus is a better company. They make better shit. They're more well-trusted. They sold out, Boeing sold out and became a public company, and then they became a cost-oriented, cut costs, hire people. But it used to be like you were proud to work for Boeing in a way that, you know, not a lot of American companies were proud and people would love it. And now it's like a normal company that has a stock price and nobody trusts anybody. And it resulted in, you know, cutting corners on this autopilot and people died. Like it's a weird thing. And that's part of why we love doing the game theory stuff. It's like, hey, you know, every now and then it's okay to just do a good job because you want to and not fire people because, like, it's fine. Like, the stock price will go back. It'll be fine. But that's not, you know, that's the Rubik's cube that we're in.
Truly. And I think this affects, like, the laptop class, especially, like, people who are in, like, big tech companies now. It's a social contagion to see, like, Elon Musk losing his mind over there. And he can slash the workforce and make everybody extremely hardcore and get into the office and no remote work and all this kind of stuff. And the people who are getting the money in their pockets, so the shareholders and board of directors, they can look at that and say, well, if this company can slash all these workers and save all these costs and still remain a successful and prominent company, why can't we do the same thing? But what that does is completely eat away at social capital. So, Nick, there was a Wall Street Journal article that you actually shared with me that we should discuss just a little bit.
Yeah,
that
was, we'll,
like,
do this.
Companies
episode,
are trying to figure out how do you get people to, like, make friends in the workplace. And the very short answer that I have, you know, and Nick, you can tell us some more details about the article. But the very short answer I have is stop fucking firing people and reorganizing. Stop doing that. Enough with the lean and effective management. Like, I get it. Executives have to prove their worth too. They have to justify their own existence. Stop doing that. If you want, if you value people making social connections beyond just going in, clocking in, and clocking out after a paycheck, then you have got to commit to the principle of getting people dedicated to the workforce. And they cannot be dedicated if they realize that the sword of Damocles is over their head and they could be let go like that, or they could be reorged like that. That's this, like, survivor's shock is the thing that's primarily motivating people to not be loyal to the company. Pizza parties and, like, weekend retreats and shit, that's fine, but that's better to do after companies already, after people already have buy-in to the company culture, and they can only do that if they know that they are safe and they have stability. So stop fucking reorganizing and letting people go because some executive thinks, oh, my spreadsheet looks better with these people off of it.
I got laid off my first job 90 days after moving across the country, so I was embittered quickly. And so now, for example, the first thing I do when I get a new job is block on all social media, every single manager that I would ever report to. Block. They cannot Google me. I don't care. And I like my managers now quite a bit. They're close and I consider them friendly. They will never, ever understand anything about my personal life. It is a wall, and because they have authority, and I'm just not going to buy in to them being able to know who I am on the internet ever again. That it will never happen again. That's not the reason I got laid off, but that kind of thing, like, this is work, Nick. This is real Nick. And you don't get to know. I'm sorry. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, no, and it makes sense. I mean, I think it's very, very wise to go into every single job, whether you like the company or not, whether you like the managers or not.
Yep.
Got to understand, the company does not care about you.
Yep.
And I don't think that attitude would have been as prevalent before this whole lean and effective management revolution in the 80s and 90s. I think it was much more common to say, like, yeah, the company actually will look after you.
Yeah,
the union is going to look after you.
Watch the Boeing documentary, for sure.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Great example.
Times they are changing.
And we're here for you, and we are sorry, and we are actually sorry. We're sorry and sorry, not sorry, not sorry.
We're sorry, sorry, and we do care about you, Player 3. Your best interests are our best interests, which is why we tell you, please do not consider us a valuable source of information or advice.
That being said, big news in the book club next week. We'll have some stuff going. It's going to be exciting.
Huge Maybe. News. We're going to talk about social collapse, everybody. Political crises. Yay. Book clubs. We got it all going on. Thank you for being patient with us.
Oh, yeah.
This
by
week.
The way, I'll tell you right now, we are going to do a Swifty episode, obviously, on the Scooter Braun stuff.
Obviously, we're doing a Swifty episode.
Totally. Yeah. Favorite Taylor Swift song, go. You know one, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. How do I choose from between my favorite children? Cruel
Chris
Summer.
Is not
baby.
A Swifty.
Cruel Summer.
Cruel Summer. Yeah. That's a good one. All right. See you then.
Thanks.